This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. One of the very few unintended benefits of the lockdowns and the school closures and distance learning is that for the first time, American parents got to see inside the schools that their children are forced to attend. And because of that, many of them are listening to my guest this week. This is my interview with Corey DeAngelis. I am joined from Washington, D.C. Apparently, that's unfortunate. By Corey DeAngelis, whose work I've been following for several years now and who has become fairly famous because education has been in the news over the last year or two. And Corey has risen to the top of the pundit class in addressing this. So it's great to have you on. This is, of course, an issue that I not only care about, but I've been kind of committed to for my entire adult life, and especially now that I'm trying to upend the whole system. But you focus on K through 12 primarily and issues of school choice. But I want to talk more broadly at first about just education. Like, why is it important? Why do you care? You're a young guy, by the way. Do you have kids?
No, I don't.
Yeah, that's odd. You got to explain that one, Corey. What is it about education, number one, why is it so important? I mean, I guess there's a lot of different answers to that, but why is it so important to you? A young guy without kids.
Yeah. So if I ever want to have kids anytime soon, I would like them to be in a system to where they can get a good education and not be residentially assigned to a government-run education provider that doesn't work. And I would like to not have to pay twice, once out of pocket for a private school to do a better job, and then to pay through property taxes for a failing school that doesn't work for them. So my future depends on it. But then, everybody goes through the school system in one form or another. Either you're homeschooled, you attend a private school growing up, or for the most families, I think 90% of students today are in some type of public school, either a public charter school or a government-run public school, and it affects all of society for a long amount of times. Mm-hmm. I went to government schools for 13 years of my life. And another reason why it's important to me is in high school, at least, I was able to go to something called a magnet school. This is still a district run, government run school. But with magnet schools, you're generally not residentially assigned to them. So they are schools of choice. And in that case, they don't have as much monopoly power in the sense that they don't have these geographic monopolies. And so I felt like that had a positive impact on my life trajectory, getting to go to a better education provider that I wasn't residentially assigned to. Mm-hmm. And I would like more people to have those types of opportunities as well for themselves and for their kids later on in life. And it shouldn't be limited to a government-run school of choice. You should be able to choose to take your education dollars to wherever you get an education, private school or some type of homeschool option as well.
Good. Good statement of principles. So you said that 90% of students in the United States are in public schools?
Yeah, public schools, which include the magnet schools, the residentially assigned district-run schools, and also public charter schools, which I should explain up front that public charter schools, although on paper in every state that I've seen are quote unquote public schools by definition, they are kind of these quasi-public, quasi-private entities that charter schools, you're generally not residentially assigned to them. They're open to the public in the sense that they have to accept all comers in general, that they can't have admissions processes, but they can be privately operated and they're publicly funded by the taxpayer. They can't charge tuition. So they're public in that sense. So they're kind of these public private quasi entities. But if you include them, it's about 90%, probably closer to 87% to be exact of the school age population. And if you look at purely government-run schools, it's even less than that. I want to say 82% of students are in government-run schools,
okay,
not including charters.
But I mean, 80 to 90, that's a high number. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they've got the overwhelming majority of children in their schools. Now, you call them, I heard this right, I think, government schools.
And the reason that I say that is because they're not really public in any meaningful sense of the word. They're not public goods. They're rivalrous and excludable. According to the economic definition, they're not accountable to the public. I don't really see democratic accountability as a strong form of accountability, as we've seen over the past year with the school board meetings. Doesn't really lead to better outcomes for the kids in the schools. It's kind of a phony form of public accountability. They're not accessible to the public. They discriminate, and for the most part, based on zip code. Families have gone to jail for trying to get their kids into better, quote unquote, public schools. So they're not open to the public, like a public park for the most part. If you want to access the public park, you can go to the public park. Yeah, it's not the same when it comes to schools. And in some school districts, in Texas, for example, if you want to go to a neighboring school district, they're even charging tuition to cover the differential in cost to send your kid to a quote unquote public school in a nearby district. So I wouldn't really think of them. They're more so government schools because they're run and operated by the government. They are regulated heavily by the government. They are funded at least through compulsion by the government, funded by the taxpayer. And they're compelled by government through compulsory education laws. And they're assigned by government with these residential assignment mechanisms. So they're government. It's more accurate to call them government schools. And this also provides some clarity too. As we were talking about earlier, I was trying to differentiate the two different types of public schools: charter public schools and then district-run public schools. Well, if you say government-run schools, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the charter schools because they're operated privately.
Okay. So when you call them government schools, though, Corey, don't you understand that that's a slur?
Well, it makes a lot of people upset. And my question back to them is, well, you know, instead of getting mad at me about calling them what they actually are, why are you upset that I am labeling them as government schools and calling them what they should be called? And the reality is people get upset about this because they understand that government doesn't do a good job at running just about anything. And it really doesn't make them feel right to accept the reality that millions of kids are stuck in government-run institutions for 13 years of their lives without exit options in the current system.
When parents drive up to the public school and drop their kid off every morning, I'm pretty sure the vast majority don't think I'm handing my kid off to the state of California.
Yeah, they don't think that. And some people will, and perhaps more people should understand that. And that's part of the reason it's important to call them what they actually are so that people have a better understanding of what's happening for 13 years of their kids' lives. And that's also another reason why the defenders of the status quo don't want you to call them government schools, because they don't want the rest of the population to figure out what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. But another thing is that some people will push back and say, oh, no, these aren't government run schools. These are run by my local school district. And then my response is, who wants to tell them, what a local school district is? It's a form of government, not to mention that there's federal education funding and strings attached to that funding, too. But some people think that if it's not the federal government, it's not the government. Well, it's still you know, regulated by local, state, and federal governments.
Of course. I think your move in describing and calling these schools government schools is crucial. I think we have to do this, and I'm going to start doing it too. And I love the response to those who will object, which is, why is it upsetting that it's the government? You know, what's your problem with the government? And especially a lot of people, we will say on the left, liberals especially, they love government and they say that. I mean, and that's not an exaggeration. I've been around many liberals, many high profile liberals who have said, you know, I love government and we need to instill a love of government in the American people. You've heard this. I mean, I'm not making this up.
Well, the same people point out that forms of government have systemic racism built into them, but then they forget about all of those things, especially when we're talking about the public school system that is segregated by race and income.
I mean, I learned, I think, all of the atrocities of government from liberals and leftists. They're the ones who taught me about all the terrible things that the United States government has done. And yet when it comes to taking care of our children, they're fine with it. I just find that bizarre. And I don't know what to do with it.
Well, a lot of these same people send their kids to private school, too. I mean, I've kind of started a map at the Educational Freedom Institute website, just tracking politicians. And, you know, it's cool that they send their kids to private school or homeschool their own kids, but then they get all up in arms about it when it comes to extending that opportunity to others. The same people who say that, you know, we should help give money to students to go to colleges. We should give money to students to go to send their kids to a pre-K provider, which can be privately operated and is usually privately operated. They're fine with all of those things. But if you want to give money directly to parents for K-12 education, they start freaking out. And it's probably because, at least for the people in office, the teachers unions disproportionately donate or contribute to Democratic politicians.
Let's do this. I want to talk about the... I'll call it a system. I've called it other things in the past, but a lot of people, I wasn't aware. And so listen, Corey, I used to be a labor expert. I used to study and write about the history of labor unions in this country. And I used to be an activist for labor unions, and I was a member of labor unions and for years and years and years. I didn't know until I think I was about 45 years old about how the teachers unions operate and how they sustain themselves. So it's a remarkable little system. I think it was actually a video from Reason that did this about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Nick Gillespie, I think, did it, where he just showed, you know, where the money goes and who gets trapped and who gets coerced. And at the end of the day, who gets paid. Do you want to like walk us through that? I mean, I know a lot of the listeners will know the basics here. You know, my audience is pretty savvy about these kinds of things, but I think when you spell it out exactly the mechanism about taxation and salaries and then donations to political candidates and how the whole apparatus works to sustain itself. Can you just talk us through that? I want it very clearly stated here.
Yeah, well, it's essentially a money laundering scheme. And the basic idea is that taxpayers are compelled to pay for the government school system, mostly through property taxes. And if they want an exit option, they essentially have to pay twice while still paying for that government-run school system. Mm-hmm. And that funding goes to pay the staff in the schools, the government employees, the teachers, and other staff. And then for the most part, those employees in the system are paying dues to the teachers unions and superintendent unions and other mm-hmm. unions, which go lobby to the government to push for higher taxes for the unwilling third party, which happens to be the taxpayer. And disproportionately, those campaign contributions have historically gone to the Democratic Party. If you look at the American Federation of Teachers, for example, where Randy Weingarten is the most unlikable teachers union boss over the past year and a half, at least. Mm-hmm. Since 1990, every single election cycle over the past three decades, over 97% of their campaign contributions in every cycle went to the Democratic Party. And so even if on the ground you have people who support reform or even school choice policies from all parties, there's a disconnect between what the voters say, the Democrats say on the ground overall nationwide, and the latest polling that I've seen at Real Clear Opinion Research found that there was actually a 12 percentage point jump in support for school choice among Democrats over the past, since April of 2020. And I think it's partially because of the school closures. There's a lot of reasons for why this might be. But with now 70% of Democrats on the ground supporting school choice, but 70% of Democrats in office certainly do not vote in favor of school choice policies. Every now and then you get one or two in a state legislature that'll, you know, make headlines because they sided with the Republicans, or at least sided with families, I would argue. But there's a huge disconnect there, and it's because they have historically relied on political campaign contributions and support from the teachers' unions.
It's an astonishing system of coercion and force. So I have to, they take my taxes. If I don't pay taxes, I go to prison. Of course, you know, by the way, a lot of liberals have actually told me that I won't go to prison if I don't pay taxes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard? I mean, they really don't know like how this, like what this is. So they take my taxes. The money goes to the salaries of teachers. Of course, everybody knows that. But what they don't know about is the dues, which you mentioned. So this part of that salary goes to the dues to the unions, which are private entities. These are not government. No one voted for any of these people. But they get up, Randy Weingarten and all the staff at the AFT, which is a massive staff because it's one of the biggest unions in the history of the world. They get our money and then they use that money to campaign to pay for ads for Democratic politicians. Again, not of our choosing. And then the Democratic politicians pass laws to further take my taxes to further fund the system.
They're using our money to advocate for policies to take away our choices. And so when we're spending money against lawsuits or anything with the teachers unions, we're essentially fighting against ourselves, at least the funding that went into to these lawsuits. It's kind of an interesting concept. And then something I forgot to point out earlier is that if you look at what the unions push for historically and what we've seen over this past year and a half, when they get more money, they don't give it to teacher salary increases, really. They put more people into the buildings.
Whoa.
And a Kennesaw State University professor, Ben Scafidi, looked at this trend between 1992 and 2014. He looked at other years too, but the one I remember is between 1992 and 2014, per pupil education expenditures in the government school system nationwide increased after adjusting for inflation by about 27%, but teacher salaries dropped by about 2% in real terms. And what he found was over a different period between 1950 and like 1990 or 2000, I don't remember, but staffing increased by about 700%, while the number of students enrolled in the school increased by less than 100%. So the staffing increased by over seven times the amount of their customers. Why? Because that means more dues-paying members. If you just increase teacher salaries, or if you increase non-staffing expenditures, well, that doesn't increase your dues-paying members in your union. And so the union's bosses have a strong incentive to just put more people into the buildings. We're seeing this year too. Los Angeles public schools, they're increasing their per pupil education expenditures from about $15,000 per student in 2019 to, in 2022, the budget numbers show it at about over $26,000 per student. So an increase of over 60% in 2 years, or in a few years. And their student enrollment is dropping by 6% this year. And a district official put out numbers that they plan to increase the number of teachers in the buildings by 8%. The number of custodial staff by 25%, and the number of psychological social workers by about 80%. In what other industry do you lose 6% of your customer base, and then at the same time you get a 60% increase in revenues while increasing employment by 8% for some employees and then higher for other groups of employees? It's totally backwards. And it's all because they know that if they have more people in the buildings, that means more power for them in the future.
For those who are listening to this and not watching on YouTube, my mouth has been open for the last 5 minutes or so as Corey's describing this. I did not know they don't even use the tax money to help their members necessarily. They just help themselves.
Right.
Getting more members in the building to pay more dues, to pay Randy Weingarten's salary so that she can pay Joe Biden. Okay.
And Randy Weingarten, by the way, according to the latest data that was reported this year, I think, in 2021, Randy Weingarten makes at least $560,000 a year. And I don't think that counts all of the, you know, the non-salary types of benefits. But yeah, the teachers unions aren't even really good for the teachers that are currently in the system, particularly right. Not the best teachers.
Right.
Because their incentive isn't to do a good. I mean, they're it's essentially a monopsony in the labor market.
Yeah.
Like a monopoly in the market for goods and services is bad for families and customers. That's obvious. We all knew that. Mm-hmm. But a monopsony or a monopoly when it comes to the labor market is bad for employees too, because their employer doesn't have a strong incentive, one, to spend the money wisely, and two, to cater to the needs of the employees. There isn't much choice in the labor market. And so I wrote an article called School Choice Benefits Teachers Too at Washington Examiner on this topic. And there's actually 5 studies that exist on the topic linking private or charter school choice to the public schools' teacher salaries. Mm-hmm. All 5 of the studies that I've seen on the topic find statistically significant positive effects of school choice competition on the teacher salaries in the public schools. Why? Because their employers start to think about where they allocate the resources, and they start to say, well, maybe we should spend the money where it matters, in the classroom, and that benefits the teachers.
So I wrote this book. This is when I was a labor historian. This is my dissertation at Columbia. It's a history of Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters, but it's really just a history of the labor movement in the United States. And I do talk about the teachers unions in it. But the argument in this book, the reason that I was shunned from academia originally and why I was told that I didn't belong, was that I make an argument in the book that, with mountains of evidence, that unions that face competition with other unions for members, see, you understand this, treat their members beautifully. They get great contracts. They're very accountable. They listen to them. They bring them into decision-making. But most importantly, they get good contracts, and they make sure their members are treated well. Otherwise, they will lose them to competing unions. And so when the AFL-CIO established itself in 1955 as a monopoly, right, basically established monopolies for all unions who are members of it, including the teachers, there hasn't been any competition really between unions since 1955. And that's why, basically, I've argued, and no one argues this except me, that's basically why the union movement in this country has fallen apart, because they have no reason to, they have no incentive to be accountable to their members. And so working class people in this country look at unions and they see a bunch of monopolist fat cats who don't do anything for anybody.
And especially post Janus, the 2018 Supreme Court decision, that now if they can't compel teachers and other public sector employees to pay union dues going forward. So some people have started to figure out that they can leave the union, and they can't be forced to pay the union dues anymore.
Oh, that's it. Oh, that's the end.
That can be a real game changer. You know, more people are still even, you know, learning that they now have that favorable Supreme Court decision. But I've made a similar argument to what you've just argued about competing, you know, labor unions improving outcomes for members, is that I don't have a problem really with private sector unions. It's when you have these public sector unions where the customers feel the pain in the relationship. I mean, think about it with schools.
Yep.
If a school closes, which we saw over the past year and a half, the people who are really screwed in this scenario are the families and their kids that don't have an exit option. So families are left scrambling, looking for an alternative while the money stays in the district system. So the district doesn't have a huge incentive really to listen to what the teachers unions want. So while the teachers unions and districts are going at it, the district doesn't feel a ton of the pain. The teachers unions certainly don't feel any of the pain. They're still getting their payments through the property tax system. And then you have the third party over here, the customer, feeling all the pain. If Walmart employees went on strike, or if Safeway grocery store employees went on strike, that would kind of suck if I really liked one of those providers, but it wouldn't be devastating to me as the customer, because I could take my money to Trader Joe's if I'd like. Mm-hmm. And then the union members and the employers would feel some of the pain in that relationship, and the employer would have an incentive to change. And so I would argue if we had school choice, if the money followed the child to wherever I wanted to get an education, well, if the public sector unions, the teachers unions and the superintendent unions were pushing for bad policies that hurt my kid, mm-hmm. well, then at least I could vote with my feet, and then maybe they'd have an incentive to push for better policies going forward.
There's a new podcast I want to tell you about. Mikkel Thorup has spent more than 20 years living, traveling, and doing business in more than 100 countries all over the world. He's now the host of the Expat Money Show podcast, which is a complete guide to moving your life, your business, and your wealth offshore. By listening to this show, you'll learn how to live and do business in foreign countries and how to protect your money from government tax collectors. Mikkel will provide you with all the information you need to know about Plan B passports, legal tax mitigation, and asset protection. Right now, you can get a free special report for unregistered listeners by going to expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered. Again, that's expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered.
It's quite a system, and we haven't even talked about maybe the worst part of it to me, which is, and this is really kind of the evil cherry on top of the sundae here. So all this whole system of coercion and force and, you know, forcing me to pay for these people to do things, they also forced me to put my son in their schools from the age of 5 to 18. And I didn't have a choice because I couldn't afford a private school and I didn't have time to homeschool him, as of course is true for the vast majority of people, which explains why they still have 90% of our children in their schools. So it's compulsory. And that's a word that people don't know. How many, you've done this work, you've talked to zillions of people. How many parents currently in the United States know that it's compulsory, that they can go, I mean, really know, like internalize this, like they're actually afraid, you know, that prison is waiting for them if they refuse to put their kids in the school. Do people know that? I don't think they do.
Yeah, I don't know any statistics on this. It would be an interesting question just to ask people nationwide. Do you know that we have compulsory education laws, or do you know that you'll go to jail if you don't send your kid to the government school and you don't submit to these homeschooling regulations, whatever it may be in your state? I mean, some states have weird homeschooling regulations too, like in New York. If you don't have your child at least the 33rd proficiency level percentile on the state tests, you can't homeschool your kid. I mean, that's what? How do you know that they're going to be at the 40th percentile if you send them to the government schools? Maybe they'll be at the 20th percentile. Like maybe they'll be worse off in the government school. And so they're essentially just disproportionately impacting the least advantaged families by saying that they're not worthy enough to homeschool in the state of New York. But the reason that I point out homeschooling laws is that I think the reason that for the most part when we get into policy debates, people don't talk as much about compulsory education laws because even though people like me agree that it could be a problem, we have an exit option, at least if you have an unregulated homeschool law. At mm-hmm. least you can just say, okay, I'm raising my kids at home. But if you have a bunch of hoops to jump through, that's where I think it becomes a problem. So I think, yeah, the compulsory education laws are pretty weakened by the reality that we generally have a lot of homeschool freedom nationwide. It's not true in every single state. Like I said, in New York, there's problems there. But we don't know if the homeschooling environment of freedom is going to be like that forever. Mm-hmm. Who knows how it will change. But I will say that also reminds me that in Utah this year, this is the only state that I've seen do this. During the pandemic, a lot of the public schools were closed, right? And so what they were starting to realize is that this could have disproportionate impacts on some families who, you know, maybe they're just not checking into Zoom. Do we want the cops coming to their house to arrest these families because they didn't have access to internet that day? Or, you know, and it was a pandemic kind of related issue that exacerbated these truancy laws. And they passed a bill this year. I'm pretty sure it got signed by the governor already, passed through both chambers. It had bipartisan support that essentially put the compulsory education law on hold for a year or two. And I think they're going to go back and push for it to say, and to say, look, we didn't need it this year. Let's just get rid of it for good. But I think Utah is the only state that I've seen that kind of action.
Oh, Utah. Okay. Yeah, no, it won't be the rest of the states, but my God, if they allow teachers to not pay union dues to the teachers unions and they eliminate compulsory education laws, I mean, that's the end. I mean, that's the end, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I also think that you also need some type of policy to have the funding follow the student, because in order to make it more feasible to have home-based education. I mean, the problem is we have a system that exists today where, you know, taxpayers are paying $15,000-$16,000 per student on a nationwide level. Some states mm-hmm. are higher, some states are lower. DC, we spend over $30,000 per kid per year. Wow. But we're paying a ton of money into this system where everybody's kind of planned their lives on the system that exists today with an expectation that we'll have that childcare for 13 years, right? And all of a sudden, you know, if you get rid of the compulsory education laws and you weaken the teachers unions with the Janus decision, which already happened, you know, a lot of people are still just going to send their kids to the government schools because of the high transaction costs or at least opportunity costs of doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll see this as the free option, and particularly for lower income families, they'll be more likely to keep their kids in that quote unquote free provider. And that's why I've argued also for school choice. I think that's the third part of the conversation that
mm-hmm.
that needs to be brought up, is that why not have that $15,000 or even less, let's say it's $12,000, have that money follow the child to either a home-based option, like a micro school, or pandemic pod was the new hip lingo for it over the past year and a half, 5 to 10 children getting together in a household where the families essentially are economizing on the process of homeschooling to make it more economically feasible, or to pay for private school tuition and fees. Nationwide, right. The average private school tuition and fees are about $11,000 or $12,000 if you look at the Private School Review website. So it's less than what we spend per child in the government schools.
Oh.
So give us a fraction. Give us a fraction of what's already being spent on the kid, and let us find an alternative. And if families want to keep their government school, then fine. They should be able to keep their government school.
Yeah, you always say you want the money to follow the student rather than the system.
Yes.
Right. That's your yeah.
Yeah, and it's applying the same logic, you know, that we already apply to higher education with Pell Grants. With Pell Grant funding, scholarship, mm-hmm. you know, essentially scholarships for higher education, the money goes to the student, and mm-hmm. they can choose a public community college if they want, but they could also choose a public university or a private religious, non-religious university. The Pell Grant funding, and same thing with the GI Bill for veterans, the funding follows the decision of the student.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with pre-K programs. You don't have to go to a residentially assigned government-run provider of pre-K to use the Head Start program, for example. Mm-hmm. You can take the money to a private religious pre-K if you want. Or right. a non-religious pre-K.
Right.
And I'm just arguing we apply that same logic where the money follows the person as opposed to a government institution, and to have the money follow the decision of the family. We do the right. same thing with food stamps. We don't tell low-income families they must spend food stamp dollars at a residentially assigned government-run grocery store.
Right.
And most people would think that that's absolutely ridiculous, whether you're for or against food stamps. If we're going to spend the money, it should go to people, not buildings.
I like the argument. Let's talk about numbers now. And I'm going to do my best to channel Randy Weingarten, who I actually met and I worked with back in the 90s briefly. So maybe I know Randy well enough to do this properly.
Well, we got to give her an award, by the way, for being the best school choice advocate of 2020 and 2021 for inadvertently doing more to advance the concept of homeschooling and parental rights and educational freedom than anyone could have ever imagined. So she's a real hero this past year.
Randy's had a tough couple of years, even tougher than a lot of people. So Randy will say, has said pretty much every day for about 40 years now, that the problem, Corey DeAngelis, you libertarian, is that we don't spend enough money on our schools. So if we, of course, Corey, if we made the, there is a number out there, isn't it, per student, you know, public spending, public education, that will ensure that, hey, listen, dude, have you been to Scandinavia? The schools there are beautiful. I've seen pictures. They are.
They spend less than us too. So.
Oh, I knew you'd have some clever answer to this. Okay.
So, well, and hold up. And in Finland, everybody likes to champion Finland. They have a nationwide school choice program. So it's funny. They pick out the certain things they like about Finland, but then they forget that they have national school choice competitive system. And right. they don't want that part. They don't want to talk about that.
They also forget that it's a capitalist economy in Finland, but
yeah,
exactly. But and Sweden and all the rest of them. But listen, so do the numbers. Since 1970, what's spending on public school been?
So we currently spend over $15,000 per student per year. And if you, after adjusting for inflation since 1960, I have that number off the top of my head. Okay. We've increased per pupil education expenditures by 287% in real terms since 1960. And, you know, our outcomes have been the same. Some would argue that we've gotten worse in some places and in some subject over time. So, you know, throwing more money at the problem is not going to fix the problem itself. You can spend $1 million per student, but if you just waste that funding and you don't actually have any incentive to spend it wisely, things aren't going to get any better, no matter how much you spend. And by the way, when you go back to Randy Weingarten and say, well, you know, we spend $15,000-$16,000 now, we've increased it by 287% in real terms since 1960 on a per pupil basis. How much is the number? What's the magic number? They never give you one. They'll never give you one because they know that you'll use it against them in the future. Once we get to that number, it's always more than what we have now. Or if you point at, hey, in New York City and in DC, and some schools are spending over $40,000 per student. Is that enough? Is that, you know, it's always more than what we spend now. And the reality is a monopoly, no matter how much you spend on it, is not going to change. And more money is not magically going to fix the inherent problem, which is that in the current system, there's a massive power imbalance between the monopoly and the parents.
Okay.
And until we fund the student directly and empower parents to make decisions for their own kids, the system's not going to listen to them.
Okay. So, the schools in Scandinavia, though, are pretty good, aren't they? Aren't they, by anybody's measure, better than ours?
Yeah, we're doing a pretty bad job. Finland has been at the top of the rankings, at least for a while. We're in the middle of the pack when it comes to PISA scores. You know, it depends on the outcome you're looking at, but typically in the middle of the pack of the OECD countries.
Right.
And we spend more than most of the countries. I think we spend more than just, I mean, I think there's one or two small countries that on a per pupil basis spend a little more than us.
Okay. But
for the most part, we spend more than the countries that are overperforming us.
Right. So in terms of test scores, that's what you're talking about, right? You're talking about test scores, testing. So they're middle of the pack. But I mean, just aesthetically, culturally, the schools, at least that I've seen, they look really nice, much more humane, smaller classes. You know, the teachers are smiling. It's not these sort of prison environments that I was used to and my son was used to. And so your explanation for why that is what? Why are Scandinavian countries, why do they have better schools than American countries? You're saying it's not because they spend more money on them.
I think at least in Finland, I don't know every country's situation. I mean, Sweden also has a statewide voucher program where money follows the student. But in Finland, at least, they have a competitive system of schools.
Okay.
And I believe they also have salaries contingent upon performance. That might not be the case, but at least they have a competitive system of schools where families can vote with their feet. And that gives the schools incentives to allocate the dollars wisely. Whereas in the current system in the US, you have these geographic monopolies. There's high transaction costs associated with picking another school. I mean, just imagine if you didn't like your restaurant or your neighborhood grocery store and you had to move houses to get access to another residentially assigned government-run grocery store, which may turn crap in a couple of years anyway because of their geographic monopoly. I mean, and what if you can't afford to move houses to a better neighborhood that has a better neighborhood grocery store or restaurant? those restaurants and grocery stores would have little to zero incentive to do a good job. That's the problem with K through 12 education in America too, which for the most part, in a lot of other developed countries, they have more choice than us. And Ashley Berner from Johns Hopkins University has actually written about this. Her book is called Educational Pluralism, is what she calls it, but it's the idea that they have more choice in education for their kids in so many other countries. And she details Denmark and Finland and places in Canada where the money follows the student,
okay,
as opposed to the building. So I would recommend that if you want to learn more about how other systems have more educational freedom than America.
Okay, so that's your thesis or hypothesis, I guess, because I know you don't study Scandinavia, but you're saying that it's the use of competition between schools, right, forces them to be better. Competition among teachers, right, for higher salaries. You want to be better than your colleague, and that you get the higher salary, right? Unions don't like that, you know. And then choice for the parents, which is all of these are market mechanisms. These are sort of all classical free market capitalist mechanisms for efficiency and greater accountability and greater production for consumers. And that's it, right? You're saying that's why other countries might have better public schools than American public schools. Is that right?
Yeah, bottom-up accountability.
Cool.
I think it's the only real form of accountability that exists.
Good.
I think all of this red tape and regulations isn't true accountability in the public school system. And this, you know, going and fighting at the school boards, you know, it may get you on TV, but when it really comes down to it, even if you get the right person in office, could say they're trying their best and then nothing actually changes. Two decades later, you have several generations of kids stuck in that system. All the meanwhile, your kid's stuck there and they got a horrible education. The only true accountability is letting me go right now.
Yeah. So, right. So you live in Washington, D.C., and you've worked for think tanks that talk to policymakers. And so you're not allowed to say certain things. But let me ask you this. Are you an abolitionist? Do you want to abolish the system or do you want to reform it?
I think the best chance that we have at getting any meaningful reform done, whether you're an abolitionist or not, you should support having the money follow the child, because it's not politically feasible to try to introduce a bill and say, let's just abolish the government school system altogether. I mean, there's a near zero chance of that happening. And at the same time, if you embrace the incremental reform of having the money follow the child, that could lead to the abolition of some government-run schools if they don't do a good job. And the way that I put it before is that underperforming private schools shut down. In the current system, underperforming government schools get more money. There's a backward set of incentives in the current system, and we can change that by having the money follow the child. And we're more likely to get political victories, at least in the short run, when we move towards money following the child.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure that's what all of your opponents assume you're after, that you're trying to dismantle the entire public education system. And when you accomplish that for your very rich friends, apparently, that's what you're doing this for. We will have generations of poor children roaming the streets because they will have no school to go to. And I mean, if the money follows the students, and you're depriving the system, and the system is what ensures that every kid in the South Bronx and South Chicago and everywhere has a place to go, at least where they take care of him from 8 to 3 every day. But if you defund the system, Corey DeAngelis, we won't have that anymore. So
the money doesn't belong to the system in the first place. It belongs to the taxpayer, and at least its intended beneficiary of that money is the family. So the way that I would put it is that school choice doesn't defund public schools. Public schools defund families, and school choice initiatives just return the money to the hands of the intended beneficiaries of that funding, which happens to be the families. And no one would say that Pell Grants steal money from community colleges just because you can use them at private religious universities like Notre Dame. No one would say that food stamp funding steals money from Walmart because you can use it theoretically to shop at Trader Joe's or Safeway. Mm-hmm. And that would sound ridiculous to everybody for all of these other programs, because we all understand that that money is not meant for the buildings. It's meant for the people, and they could take it to those buildings that they want. And the same thing applies to K-12 education. If you want to take the money to the government school system, you can still do that. And I mean, this essentially is a way that the defenders of the status quo are telling on themselves. They understand they're not doing a good job for so many families, and they're not actually educating the kids that are there. And they're terrified of any change. They're terrified of allowing their captives to have a choice to go to a competing institution. So them screaming that they're going to be destroyed by having any competition whatsoever, that's an argument for choice, not against it.
Yeah.
Because look, I mean, Advantage families are already able to get out of those schools. They're able to pay out of pocket for private school tuition and fees, mm-hmm. in addition to paying for the public schools. And they're more likely to be able to be assigned to a better, quote unquote, public school by living in a more expensive neighborhood. So they're really only trapping the least advantaged in these schools by forcing low-income families to spend their kids' education dollars at that government-run, residentially assigned school. So I'm not arguing to abolish all taxes. I'm not arguing to not fund education. I'm arguing to have the education dollars that we're already spending just reallocated from the buildings to the people so that more families can have choice.
Okay. Well, if you were more of a radical abolitionist type, and you did just succeed in defunding many or most or all schools in this country, you know, we would potentially have children roaming the streets, right? We'd be back to the 19th century. Maybe.
It's already happening. That's already happened. You already have people dropping out of school.
Right.
You already have people actually getting into a lot of negative environments in the schools, getting into fights, doing drugs, yeah, getting no into kidding. Gangs. I mean, there's negative aspects to the schools today that the defenders of the status quo will pretend that don't happen. They'll always compare your policy proposal, which in this case happens to be school choice, to perfection, which perfection isn't what we have in the current system. I think there was a story in Baltimore public schools, for example, where like someone had graduated with like a 0.1 GPA, graduated from the school system. And and then they were saying like a huge proportion of them, I don't remember the data off the top of my head, but I tweeted about it, is that like a large proportion of the students had a 1.0 or below GPA. It was just, and they spend tons of money. I think nearly $20,000 per student per year.
Wow.
In Baltimore City public schools. Why not give those students a fraction of that money, $15,000, $16,000, and let them choose? And another thing is, you know, when people say like, oh, this is going to cause all these problems. One, the problems already exist. And then two, like, just imagine, like, even if we were talking about like reducing the amount of funding that is taken from us through the property tax system, if we did that, I mean, just imagine if people applied this argument to food. Oh, if we didn't have government grocery stores and we didn't fund all food through property taxes, how would anybody eat?
Yeah.
I mean, most people can figure it out. And for the least advantage, what do? We have food stamp funding and right. other types of support services, but it's right. only for the least advantaged that we do that. And so the tax expenditure there is much lower than funding food stamps for 100% of people in population, having government run all the grocery stores and to pay for all that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Instead, we just apply there's also voluntary donations that can happen as well, which is the more libertarian response. But even then, why fund it for everybody if you can just fund it for, so if we did like a thought experiment with the school system, I mean, we're essentially funding food stamps for everybody when it comes to K-12 education.
Right.
And having government run all the schools.
Right.
But if we started over, you could imagine a different system where we fund vouchers for the least advantaged, essentially, and allow the rest to be privately funded.
Sometimes we all have to look for things on the internet that we don't want other people to know about. And this is a real problem for most of us. Now, I know most of you are thinking, why don't you just use incognito mode? But let me tell you something. Incognito mode does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Your internet service provider can still see every single website you've ever visited. So that's why, even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter who your ISP is, internet service providers in the US can legally sell your information to ad companies. But ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background and it's so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse at all for not using it. Protect your online activity today with a VPN rated number one by CNET. Visit my exclusive link, expressvpn.com/unregistered, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/unregistered. expressvpn.com/unregistered to learn more.
That's not going to happen anytime soon, but that is a thought experiment to a way to think of, you know, just something to think about with how we do fund education and how we might think about how we should have funded education.
Yeah. I know, again, you don't study the whole world, but I keep my mind keeps going outside the United States for comparisons, you know, for counter examples. And so you must have studied this a bit or know about it. I mean, I've heard about these private schools in India and sub-Saharan Africa that apparently, again, I haven't done the research. I don't know. I've just heard libertarians talk about this. They say libertarians have been telling me for a few years now that there's this sort of giant sort of network of private schools in the poorest places on earth, and that the poorest children on earth are able to attend them and afford them in mass numbers. Is this true?
Yeah, and they're paying out of pocket for it in addition to the tax system for the quote unquote free public schools. And the reason why they're doing this in countries like India is that, you know, the public school system's not doing all that great in the United States in a lot of places, but in some parts of places in India, for example, they're even worse, where the teachers don't even show up. And so like there's not much of a benefit at all. And so in order to have any benefit at all, the families are still scraping by to send their kid to a private education provider. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the reasons. And if you want to learn more about the low cost private schools in India and elsewhere, I would recommend James Tooley. He's a researcher at, I don't remember, but he's in the UK.
Yeah.
And actually one of the people I did a PhD with, Denise Shakil at the University of Arkansas, I believe he's now a professor over there working under with James Tooley. So I think his book is called A Beautiful Tree, if you want to check that out. And then also I think he's done work with a researcher at Newcastle University in the UK named Pauline Dixon, who's great on this subject as well. But low cost private schools are another option, and they're more likely to sprout up when the public schools are super, super bad in an area.
Well, how is it possible though? I mean, again, you're not an expert on this, but I'm just trying to guess, like, how could this be? How could the poorest people on earth afford a private school? I mean, how do they keep the costs low?
Yeah, I mean, there might be volunteer tutors or educators. I'm kind of thinking of what we've had this past year and a half with the pandemic pods, where you don't have to build another brick and mortar school with all the frivolous amenities. You pretty much get kids together in a household with one of the parents, you could either pay that parent to essentially be the homeschool parent, or you could even have one parent do math and only do it one day a week, and then another parent do reading, and then have another parent do another subject, to where you're pooling resources together to make it more economically feasible to provide a home-based education. And the good thing is you wouldn't have to build a new building to do so, and have to invest in all those fixed costs. So that's one way to make it super low cost. But we also have like low cost private schools in North Carolina. And Reason TV actually did a video on this. I believe Nick Gillespie was narrating it, but it was about Thaley. It was called Thaley's Academy. And I think it was started by Bob Luddy in North Carolina, but they're not super low cost. It's not like, you know, $1,000 a year or anything. It's, I think they're like $5,000 a year. And they're pretty affordable, and they have a model that is interesting to look at as well.
No kidding. I love it. Okay. When I heard about that, it was too good to be true. And I kind of wanted to get some confirmation from someone else, but I think there seems to be another education economy out there that's possible. Like, there's another way to structure the whole system that's radically different, that is actually going to serve. And again, this, we're mostly concerned about poor people, right? Because wealthy people can take care of their kids. They can send their kids to wherever they want, or they can hire fancy tutors to be homeschoolers or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think for the poorest of us, I think it sounds like that might be a better option than these places that look to me like prisons. And I haven't asked you that, you know, but do you consider them prisons? I do.
Yeah, the way that a few thinkers, I don't know if it was John Taylor Gatto or Peter Gray might have said this, but they're a form of state-sanctioned child abuse. And, you know, the way that I put it on Twitter, at least, is that trapping kids in government schools for 13 years without exit options is a large-scale form of state-sanctioned child abuse. And in a way, they do have parallels with prisons. But the only difference is with children, their only crime is being the wrong age. I think that's another quote from Peter Gray. Their only crime is being the wrong age. But at least with prisons, the argument at least is that you broke the law and you're found guilty of a crime. Sometimes you're wrongfully convicted, but for the most part, you're found guilty of something.
Their only crime is being of the wrong age.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have shared the pictures of, you have the jail and then you have the school. They look very similar. They're these big warehouse factory, you know, institutions, and you're compelled to go to them unless you can afford the cost. You're compelled to send your kids to them unless you can afford to pay for the costs associated with home-based education or private school tuition and fees. And if you don't, you can get in trouble.
Yeah, it's quite a thing. Okay, let's finish by talking about the last couple of years, which we've already mentioned this a few times, but looks to be perhaps a turning point in the history of education in the United States, at least, maybe in the world. But yeah, and CRT, the whole controversy, and I know you were involved in that. I'll just tell us what's been going on the last couple of years. How do you see it, and how does CRT fit into this thing, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, the way that I would put it is that COVID didn't break the public school system; it was already broken. Yeah. And that the past year and a half has simply shined a spotlight on the main problem with K-12 education in America, which is this massive power imbalance between the union monopoly and individual families. So families have woken up with the school closures. They saw that, you know, if their neighborhood grocery store closed down, it was kind of inconvenient, but at least they could take their money to another provider if they wanted to. But when their kids' schools were closed, they were scrambling for private alternatives, at least if they had the means to do so, or at least they were, a lot of families lost their jobs from having to go back. Disproportionately, females lost their jobs over the past year and a half from going back into the household,
mm-hmm.
Because they had to pay through the property tax system for these employees that sat at home and refused to go back to work. Whereas the private schools were fighting to reopen all across the country, or they didn't even close. I mean, and so you had like these legal challenges in places like Michigan, Ohio, California, Kentucky, several states. Whenever the governors were closing the private schools, the private school leaders filed legal cases to get around to for the right to open for their customers, because they knew that if they didn't provide a meaningful service, and for a lot of families, the in-person instruction was a meaningful service. And if they couldn't justify that tuition payment with the services that were rendered, that they were going to have to shut down those private schools. But the public schools, they knew that they could keep their revenues the same while still keeping their doors closed. But it was worse than that, actually. It's not just that they knew that they wouldn't be harmed by keeping their doors closed. They knew they could profit from keeping their doors closed because they could lobby to the government and say, well, in order to open, we have to have $190 billion, which is what they got from Congress since March of 2020. And that money wasn't even contingent upon reopening the schools in person. They're just spending it on stadiums and stuff now. I mean, they have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. But they knew this. They knew that they could leverage the state of disorder and hold children's education hostage in order to get more money. I mean, it's the same as my old axiom that I mentioned earlier, that when a private school does a bad job, it shuts down. When a public school does a bad job, they get more money. And we saw this with the pandemic as well. Right. When they're failing, they could say, oh, we're failing because we have more money. When they're closed, they could say, well, we're closed because we need more money. And they got it. So it's
just like banks, right? When they fail, they get more money.
Yeah, they're too big to fail. The government school system's too big to fail. There's 90% mm-hmm. of kids there. But so that was part of it, you know, just the school closures and families saying, well, what the hell? The buildings aren't providing the service. They're still getting my kids money. It started to make more sense, the idea that the money should follow the child, because mm-hmm. they were in such a tough spot.
Yeah.
And they felt powerless, right? And powerless to a point to where parents aren't going to ever forget it. And they're going to push and fight as hard as possible going forward for mm-hmm. money following the child and school choice policies, so they don't feel powerless ever again. The other thing was the remote learning. And I don't know if you can call it remote learning in a lot of places, because it was this government form of remote education, or remote instruction at least, that didn't work for a lot of families. They kind of slapped it together really quickly. They didn't have processes in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue they probably didn't do as good of a job as the virtual charter schools that had been doing this for decades. And so families saw that this wasn't really working out, but they also saw what the teachers were talking about with the kids. And they had an eye into the classroom like they had never had before.
Yeah, right.
And so a lot of families started to hear some like political bias into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are talking about critical race theory, which, you know, a lot of people have a hard time even defining it.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to the mainstream media, they'll hit you with a bunch of gaslighting and say, oh, well, this isn't happening in any schools because it's only taught in law schools. But the reality is, even if that's true, parents know what they were upset about with what they saw. And so with the media and politicians trying to tell them that families don't know what they're talking about, that's not going to really work out all that well for those politicians, because parents aren't stupid. They heard what they heard. They're seeing what they're seeing with the FOIA requests now and what's in their curriculum. Another part of it is like the sexualized curriculum. Some families aren't happy about that. Mm-hmm. Some families just want the schools to pay more attention to the basics, math, reading, and science. And so that's another part of the issue that has fueled the movement for school choice as well, is that, you know, for a long time, the argument for having the money follow the child was that, well, the public schools are doing bad when it comes to math and reading test scores. But that doesn't mobilize parents as much as, well, your kid's being indoctrinated in a way that doesn't align with your values for 13 years. That mm-hmm. really upsets parents, and it gets them to push for policy reform. And I think that's what we've seen some of in the past year and a half. And from my perspective, it goes both ways, right? That a one size fits all system shouldn't be forced on anybody, regardless of what your political ideology is, and regardless of what kind of education you want for your kid, and regardless of your values in general. That if you want to choose a school that has critical race theory or teaches through a critical race theory lens, you should be able to choose that. But you at the same time shouldn't be able to force all kids into a system that teaches in that way. And so the problem isn't critical race theory per se, or the curriculum in certain schools per se. The problem is the system itself. And I think all of these things that we've seen, whether, you know, there've been tons of battles. There's been curriculum battles with CRT and sexualized curriculum. There has been battles about whether we should do remote versus in-person versus hybrid instruction. There have been battles over different discipline policies in the school, you name it. But they're all just symptoms of the real problem, which is the one size fits all school system, that we're not all going to agree about how to raise our children. I mean, our children may have different interests. They may have different abilities when it comes to different subjects, and families have different values. And that's we got to be okay with that. And the only way that we can move forward through freedom rather than force, the only way that we move forward without forcing our values on other people's kids, is to allow the money to follow the child. Then you can take your kids' education dollars to an institution that aligns with your values.
Right.
That's a CRT school. Great. If it's a 1776 curriculum school, that's great too. If it's a school that just wants to focus on the basics, that's cool too. But that's the only way we get out of this mess.
Yeah. Nice. Virginia, I mean, Terry McAuliffe did great service to you, didn't he? By saying,
yeah, well, and Randy Weingarten did a great service to Glenn Youngkin by stumping for Terry McAuliffe the night before the election.
That's right.
The most hated union member in the country, or at least teachers union member in the country at the moment, it seems, Randy Weingarten.
I'm sure.
It should have been counted as an in-kind contribution for the Youngkin campaign, especially after Terry McAuliffe during the final debate said, and I quote, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach." And then it was worse than that, because he kept tripling and quadrupling down on the anti-parent rhetoric. He didn't walk it back. Yep. And then he even had the union boss stumping for him the night before the election. And parents were pissed off about that. You're gonna take the side of the teachers union and the person who closed schools in a state like Virginia that had the schools closed longer than most other states.
Yeah.
That didn't sit well with parents. And especially, you know, Loudoun County was the epicenter of the critical race theory curriculum battles and school board battles. Those parents that showed up at the school board meetings showed up at the ballot box too. And Glenn Youngkin, in a state that went 10 percentage points to Biden, ended up winning by over 2 percentage points. It swung over about 12 percentage points the other way in just 1 year.
All those conservative and maybe not so conservative parents in Virginia found out that their kids were in government schools.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't know before. Now they know what it means to be in a government school, that you don't get to decide what the curriculum is at all. It's unelected bureaucrats who get to decide what is taught to your child. They didn't know that until now. Thank you, Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah, so Virginia was an eye opener. It was an eye opener for politicians too, that they're understanding, I think, a little bit more now, at least, that like parents are this new special interest group that's kind of emerged in K-12 education. For a long time, it was only the employees unions. Now it's kind of like a parent union coming out. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, it's turning out to be politically disastrous, and that's a good thing, to come out against parental rights.
Yeah.
And so it would be wise for politicians going forward to follow the Youngkin lead and lean into parental rights and educational freedom, because this new special interest group is paying attention. And if you come out against them, well, they're going to come out against you. Now you don't just have to worry about the teachers unions look and what they care about. Now you have this organized group of parents who are watching as well. And so I'm optimistic going forward, because parents are going to fight for the right to educate their kids as they see fit harder than anyone will fight to take that right away from them. Mm-hmm. And so more and more politicians are going to listen to them, especially because parents aren't going to forget what they saw. They're not going to want to feel powerless like they did in 2020 ever again. They're going to fight to make sure that never happens. And they're not going to just sit down and shut up no matter how many times the National School Board Association and other members of the establishment try to label them as domestic terrorists. These parents are just going to keep pushing back, and they're going to only be more emboldened to fight for their kids going forward. And real quick, another, yeah. You know, Virginia was one of the victories there for parental rights, but 2021 is also the year of school choice, or if you're hip with the lingo by now, 2021 is the year that we fund students, not systems. Mm-hmm. 19 states already have expanded or enacted programs to fund students directly. And if you compare that to the previous legislative session, I think I can only recall one state, Utah, that passed a new private school choice program in the previous legislative session. Whereas in 2021, 19 states either expanded or enacted new programs. And the number of states with education savings account programs, which I believe are the purest form of funding families directly, doubled from 5 states to 10 states. And the victories have been huge too in some states, like West Virginia. They didn't have any private school choice programs. They didn't have any charter schools. But in West Virginia, they passed the most expansive education savings account program in the nation. So regardless of income, you can take your kids' state-level education dollars to the private or public education provider of your choosing. You can take it to a micro school, you can pay for private tutoring, pay for private school tuition and fees, any approved education provider of your choosing.
Yeah. Distance learning, it turns out, was a wonderful thing because it allowed parents to see inside the schools.
Yeah, that's right. That's and that's another reason why I think there are pushes, not just for school choice bills, but also for transparency bills.
Yeah.
That you have some states pushing bills to post the curriculum online. Some people are pushing for cameras in the classroom, or at least recordings. And I think that's a little, you know, a little much at this point. But, yeah. You know, I think the better solution is to just have choice. And then if a school, you know, if parents pressure a school to have cameras in the classroom and in this area, then they should be able to choose to do that. But as far as the state coming down and telling every school that they must have cameras in the classroom, I think that's a little much. But look, if you're forcing everybody to pay for this system, at least parents should be able to know what the curriculum is without having to go through the hoops of the FOIA request to figure it out. I mean, that's just a lot of extra steps.
Yeah.
And with these transparency bills, which I think have a good shot of passing, who wants to come out against transparency, right? I mean,
right.
You just want more information for what, and you're not even, this isn't even a bill to let me choose to exit the school. It's just what's going on in my school. And with these kind of bills, that will continue the momentum, I believe, for school choice policy, because with more information, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Either the public schools will change their game and start to listen to parents more, or parents will see that, you know, this school board and curriculum isn't aligned with my views. I really need an exit option. So they'll push for school choice bills going forward too.
Yeah. My son went to one of the most prestigious California public schools, meaning it had the highest test, among the highest test scores, right? One of those schools. And he would bring home, you know, his work, and I would see it. And his English teacher, Corey DeAngelis, would send home assignments, and she would write that were, I once counted 27 spelling and grammatical errors on one sheet of paper. This was his English teacher at one of the best public schools, government schools in the state of California, which is one of the highest educated states as well. So why can't we, I mean, so that's a little transparency I got to see only by accident because my son showed it to me. But if I had a camera inside those rooms and I saw what these people are actually saying, in fact, I did during some Zoom meetings. My son is now out of school, thank God. But I was at a friend's house and I watched her 10-year-old daughter do a Zoom thing with her teacher, and it was horrifying. It was horrifying.
Yeah, so the argument from the establishment will be, well, oh, you're infringing on teachers' rights. Oh, you want to look at kids. I've heard that one. That's a little ridiculous.
Oh, nice.
I mean,
nice.
Of course they're going to pull that. But
wow.
I mean, the obvious solution is no, the camera's not on the kids. The camera's on the teacher or at least the whiteboard or what's going on at the front of the classroom. Or you could just have an audio recording and only have it for parents where you don't have to have anything visible. But the other thing that's kind of the elephant in the room is that they were just doing this all the past year and a half and actively pushing for it. They were okay with cameras watching them as long as they got to sit at home in the PJs.
That's right. That's right.
But now that they get to go back to work, now cameras in the classroom, if I'm going to have to go back to work now, that's just an infringement on my rights. But if you let me stay at home and not have to actually do the hard work of the childcare part of the service of the government school system, now I'm going to complain about that.
Because police officers are the tip of an oppressive spear, right? They're just they're agents of an oppressive racist institution, the United States government. We have body cameras on them. We have cameras on. We want full transparency on police officers, but this other agent of the state, the teacher, can't have that. Apparently we can let them do whatever they want.
What's interesting is a lot of, I think the good police officers, the better ones at least, like body cameras because it gives them, it shows that they didn't do anything wrong. So if they get complaints against them, it's like, no, actually the person I was arresting, that's the person that was the problem, not me. And teachers similarly, there are bad acting teachers and there are good teachers in the system. Sure. And I would think that the higher quality teachers that are doing things that are aligned with the values of the families, they would be more likely to be okay with it, especially if they get a complaint or maybe there's just disorder in the classroom. This way they could show the parent of the child that, you know, you're sending your kid to school and this is why I discipline them, for example, because they're causing a ruckus and it makes it more difficult for me to educate the rest of the class. So yeah, those are all interesting points. And it, what's interesting to me is a lot of people will label me as a conservative just because I support one policy and that it happens to be that I push everything through education policy. And I don't really focus on a bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. And so like I'll push for school choice on social media and then I'll get people responding to me saying, well, how about vouchers for the police? How about we have police choice? I'm like, actually, I wrote an article about that. It's about 30 pages at least in libertarian papers, peer reviewed, where I argue for police vouchers because of geographic monopoly police departments.
Nice.
And if you had bottom-up accountability and allowed people to choose their police department, well, then they can choose based on response times. They can choose based on whether the police officer is engaging in inappropriate conduct. Maybe they're shooting innocent people and we have proof of that. Maybe I should be able to vote with my feet to another department. But most people don't know that. So they try to come at me with this caricature that they have in me that doesn't align with their preconceived notions. And it puts them into a bad situation.
I don't think there's anything.
Oh, would you call them government police? Yeah, actually I did in this article. I refer to them as government police.
That's beautiful. There is nothing conservative about any of your ideas as far as I can tell. Right? I mean, you're a revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, the reason that the argument from the other side is that, or the reason that I'm put into this box is because I specialize on school choice policy.
Yeah.
School choice happens to be on the Republican Party platform of in a lot of states. Mm-hmm. And so we align. More of my friends are in the Republican Party when it comes to school choice, but not all issues, but it just happens that I specialize, which makes it difficult for my opponents when it comes to school choice policy to put me into a box.
Well, hang on now. So let's explain why you're not a conservative. Conservatives do not want a system in which it is possible to open a critical race theory school.
Yeah.
You do.
I do. Yeah. And that's an embrace that embraces freedom. But at the same time, like the Republicans I've seen, when they push school choice bills, I don't think that they're signing on to say you can't choose a school that has critical race theory in the private school. I think it's typically, even when they do the critical race theory ban bills, which I think, you know, aren't going to achieve what they actually want to achieve. And I think is the less optimal solution as opposed to school choice and letting the market decide. Those typically apply to the public schools, not the private schools.
Right.
Great. But yeah, there are some conservatives though that do say, hey, yeah, we shouldn't be able to have critical race teaching charter schools, for example. And
I mean, don't we want to align there? Yeah, don't most conservatives want to use government schools to indoctrinate children just differently? I mean, don't they want to use that apparatus for their own purposes?
Some do. Yeah, I don't know the percentage, but yeah.
I mean, wasn't that the whole 1776 project, right? And Trump's whole position on this was that we should force children to read something else in the schools, right?
Yeah. They had a different curriculum, one size fits all curriculum.
Yeah.
In the schools. But at the same time, Trump, for all of the negative things that he said and did, he supported school choice policies. That was the one silver lining, I guess. Bright side, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, it depends on the person, but there has been a push for the one size fits all curriculum of another angle.
Exactly.
By the conservatives.
Yeah.
I want to align with.
Exactly. So you worked with Reason and Cato for a long time, and now you're with another organization. Who are you with now?
Yep. American Federation for Children. It's a nationwide school choice advocacy group.
Okay.
We have 501c3, 501c4, and PAC capabilities. So it's a little different from the normal think tanks like Reason and Cato, which are only have C3 arms.
Well, Corey, I hope you win everything that you want in this. I am completely on your side in this. I think you're doing amazing work. I think you're doing the best work there is on education policy, at least that I've seen in this country. And Godspeed.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I think we are going to win. People are finally figuring out that there isn't any good reason to fund failing institutions when we can fund the people directly instead.
Beautiful. Thank you, sir. Good luck out there.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Okay. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.